This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This opening music is courtesy of Joseph Martin, Professor of Music at the Lamont School of Music at Denver University. Welcome to the Poetry Corner. Our first poem is from Lewis Carroll, and it appears in the fourth chapter of Through the Looking Glass. And it is recited there to Alice by Tweedledum and Tweedledee, the walrus and the carpenter. The sun was shining on the sea, shining with all his might. He did his very best to make the billows smooth and bright, and this was odd because it was the middle of the night. The moon was shining sulkily because she thought the sun had got no business to be there after the day was done. It's very rude of him, she said, to come and spoil the fun. The sea was wet as wet could be, the sands were dry as dry. You could not see a cloud because no cloud was in the sky. No birds were flying overhead, there were no birds to fly. The walrus and the carpenter were walking close at hand. They wept like anything to see such quantities of sand. If this were only cleared away, they said, it would be grand. If seven maids with seven mops swept it for half a year, do you suppose, the walrus said, that they could get it clear? I doubt it, said the carpenter, and shed a bitter tear. Oh, oysters, come and walk with us, the walrus did beseech. A pleasant walk, a pleasant talk, along the briny beach. We cannot do with more than four, to give a hand to each. The eldest oyster looked at him, but never a word he said. The eldest oyster winked his eye and shook his heavy head, meaning to say he did not choose to leave the oyster bed. But four young oysters hurried up, all eager for the treat. Their coats were brushed, their faces washed, their shoes were clean and neat. And this was odd because, you know, they hadn't any feet. Four other oysters followed them, and yet another four. And thick and fast they came at last, and more, and more, and more, all hopping through the frothy waves and scrambling to the shore. The walrus and the carpenter walked on a mile or so, and then they rested on a rock, conveniently low, and all the little oysters stood and waited in a row. The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings, and why the sea is boiling hot, and whether pigs have wings. But wait a bit, the oysters cried, before we have our chat, for some of us are out of breath, and all of us are fat. No hurry, said the carpenter. They thanked him much for that. A loaf of bread, the walrus said, is what we chiefly need. Pepper and vinegar, besides, are very good indeed. Now, if you're ready, oysters dear, we can begin to feed. But not on us, the oysters cried, turning a little blue. After such kindness, that would be a dismal thing to do. The night is fine, the walrus said. Do you admire the view? It was so kind of you to come, and you are very nice. The carpenter said nothing but, cut us another slice. I wish you were not quite so deaf. I've had to ask you twice. It seems a shame, the walrus said, to play them such a trick, after we brought them out so far and made them trot so quick. The carpenter said nothing but, the butter spread too thick. I weep for you, the walrus said. I deeply sympathize. With sobs and tears he sorted out those of the largest size, holding his pocket handkerchief before his streaming eyes. Oh, oysters, said the carpenter, you've had a pleasant run. Shall we be trotting home again? An answer came there none, and this was scarcely odd because they'd eaten every one. Who do these characters represent? Good guess. A lot of suggestions have been made, both religious and political. But I defer to Martin Gardner, who in his work, The Annotated Alice, noted that there was not always intended symbolism in the Alice books. They were meant for the imagination of children, not the analysis of mad people. So with that in mind, this program is dedicated to humorous or nonsense poems in the sense that they evoke a smile or a feeling of curiosity rather than any other emotion. So from Lewis Carroll, we move to Mother Goose. Little Miss Muffet sat on her tuffet eating her curds and whey. Along came a spider and sat down beside her and frightened Miss Muffet away. Did you know there really was a Miss Muffet? In the 16th century, there was an English physician and scientist, Dr. Thomas Muffet, whose specialty was insects, especially spiders. And there's some suspicion that he even believed in the healing quality of ingesting them. We keep that in mind when we listen to the verse. Many of the Mother Goose verse seem like nonsense, unless a setting for them is described. Some were meant to parody the curious activities of the aristocracy and others in authority. The next example has been connected with Mother Goose at various times, and its humor is based on its contradictions. Two dead boys. Ladies and gentlemen, skinny and stout, I'll tell you a tale I know nothing about. The admission is free, so pay at the door. Now pull up a chair and sit on the floor. One bright day in the middle of the night, two dead boys got up to fight. Back to back, they faced each other, drew their swords, and shot each other. One was blind and the other couldn't see, so they chose a blind man for a referee. A blind man went to see fair play. A mute man went to shout, hooray! A deaf policeman heard the noise and came and killed those two dead boys. He lived on the corner in the middle of the block, in a two-story house on a vacant lot. A man with no legs came walking by, kicked the lawman in the thigh. He crashed through a wall without making a sound, into a dry creek bed, and suddenly drowned. The long black hearse came to cart him away, but he ran for his life, and is still gone today. I watched from the corner of the big round table, the only eyewitness to the facts of my fable. But if you doubt my lies are true, just ask the blind man. He saw it too. A similar example of someone in a position of authority without any real experience for being there might appear in Gilbert and Sullivan's operetta, The HMS Pinafore. Here follows are Gilbert's words for the general song. I am the very model of a modern major general. I've information vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England, and I quote the fights historical, from Marathon to Waterloo, in order categorical. I'm very well acquainted, too, with matters mathematical. I understand equations, both the simple and quadratical. About binomial theorem, I'm teeming with a lot of news, with many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse. I'm very good at integral and differential calculus. I know the scientific names of being animalculous. In short, in matters vegetable, animal, and mineral, I am the very model of a modern major general. I know our mythic history, King Arthur's and Sir Carteret's. I answer hard acrostics. I have a pretty taste for paradox. I quote in elegiacs all the crimes of Heliogapolis. In conics, I can four peculiarities parabolas. I can tell undoubted Raphaels from Gerald Dow's and Zophanes. I know the croaking chorus from the frogs of Aristophanes. Then I can hum a fugue of which I've heard the music's din afore and whistle all the airs from that infernal nonsense pinafore. Then I can write a washing bill in Babylonic cuneiform and tell you every detail of Caratacus's uniform. In short, in manners vegetable, animal, and mineral, I am the very model of a modern major general. In fact, when I know what is meant by Mamelon and Ravelin, when I can tell at sight a Mauser rifle from a javelin, with such affairs as sorties and surprises I'm more wary at, and when I know precisely what is meant by commissariat. When I've learned what progress has been made in modern gunnery, when I know more of tactics than a novice in a nunnery. In short, when I've a smattering of elemental strategy, you'll say a better major general has never sat a gee. For my military knowledge, though I'm plucky and adventury, has only been brought down to the beginning of the century, but still, in matters vegetable, animal, and mineral, I am the very model of a modern major general. There is another nursery rhyme that doesn't appear until the early 1900s that also has an interesting past. A student at Oxford, Thomas Brown, was caught in some tomfoolery. He was threatened with expulsion by the dean, one Dr. Fell, but was given a second chance if he could extemporaneously translate a poem by the Roman author Martial. Martial's poem is as follows, and even though it is in Latin, you can hear the meter. Non amo te, sabidi, nec possum dicere quare, hoc tandem possum dicere, non amo te. Its strict translation is, I do not love you, Sabinius, nor is it possible to say why. But this I can say, I do not love you. Brown was not expelled, and regardless of how he translated it that day, in Mother Goose tradition it came out as, I do not like thee, Dr. Fell, the reason why is hard to tell. But this I know, and know full well. I do not like thee, Dr. Fell. Martial, who lived from 40 to 140 CE, was considered the greatest epigrammist of the ancient world. What is an epigram? A dwarfish whole. Its body is brevity, and its wit, its soul. In other words, one-liners. Here are some of them. You disappoint no creditor, you say. True. No one ever thought that you would pay. Or, you ask me how my farm can pay since little it will bear. It pays me thus, 'tis far away, and you are never there. And, once a surgeon, Dr. Baker, then became an undertaker. Not so much his trade reversing, since for him it's just rehearsing. So much for the ancient, now for the modern. And in the modern, probably most recognizable is Ogden Nash. Candy is dandy, but liquor is quicker. Or, children aren't happy with nothing to ignore, and that's what parents were created for. Or from the other side, oh, what tangled web do parents weave when they think their children are naive. And, no, you never get much fun out of things you haven't done. And similarly, why did the Lord give us agility, if not to evade responsibility? And then there was a very famous takeoff he once did of Joyce Kilmer's trees. I think that I shall never see a billboard lovely as a tree. Perhaps unless the billboards fall, I'll never see a tree at all. There is a longer piece that Ogden Nash wrote, I believe in response to children questioning rules. It is entitled, Lines to be Embroidered on a Bib, or The Child is Father of the Man, but not for quite a while. So Thomas Edison never drank his medicine. So Blackstone and Hoyle refused cod liver oil. So Sir Thomas Mallory never heard of a calorie. So the Earl of Lennox murdered Rizzio without the aid of vitamins or calisthenics. So Socrates and Plato ate dessert without finishing their potato. So spinach was too spinachy for Leonardo da Vinci. Well, it's all immaterial, so eat your nice cereal. And if you want to name your ration, first, go get a reputation. Or his remembrance back to the difference between the first and the second born child. First child. Be it a girl or one of the boys, it is scarlet all over, it's a vaudepoise. It is red, it is boiled. Could the obstetrician have possibly been a lobstertrician? His degrees and credentials were hunky-dory, but how's for an infantile inventory? Here's the prodigy, here's the miracle, whether its head is oval or spherical. You rejoice to find it has only one, having dreaded a two-headed daughter or son. Here's the phenomenon, all complete. It's got two hands, it's got two feet. Only natural, but pleasing, because for months you have dreamed of flippers or claws. Furthermore, it is fully equipped fingers and toes with nails are tipped. It's even got eyes and a mouth clear cut. When the mouth comes open, the eyes go shut. When the eyes go shut, the breath is loosed, and the presence of lungs can be deduced. Let the rockets flash and the cannon thunder. This child is a marvel, a matchless wonder. A staggering child, a child astounding, dazzling, diaperless, dumbfounding, stupendous, miraculous, unsurpassed. A child to stagger and flabbergast. Bright as a button, sharp as a thorn, and the only perfect one ever born. Second child. Arrived this evening at 9:30. Everybody is doing fine. Is it a boy or quite the reverse? You can call in the morning and ask the nurse. Another noted American poet of humorous verse was Los Angeles area resident Richard Armour. Two of his most noted one-liners have often been mistakenly attributed to Ogden Nash. They were, "Shake and shake the ketchup bottle. None'll come, and then a lot'll." And, "Nothing attracts the mustard from wieners as much as the slacks just back from the cleaners." And some of his other short verse that may be worthy of reflection, "My mattress and I. Night after night for years on end, my mattress has been my closest friend. My mattress and I are cozy and pally. There are hills on the sides. I sleep in the valley. It clearly reveals the shape that I'm in. Where I'm thin, it's thick. Where it's thick, I'm thin. Its contours reflect the first and the last of me. It's very nearly a plaster cast of me. I miss my mattress when I'm gone. It's one thing I've made an impression on." Next, "My food grows colder. Please don't get up," she said to me while pausing at my table. But I got up so she could see I'm courteous and able. She little knew that when I sup good manners I am blind to, for till she said, "Please don't get up," it hadn't crossed my mind to. Good sportsmanship. Good sportsmanship we hail, we sing. It's always pleasant when you spot it. There's only one unhappy thing. You have to lose to prove you've got it. To have and too old. The bride, white of hair, is stooped over her cane. Her faltering footsteps need guiding. While down the church aisle with wan toothless smile, the groom in a wheelchair comes riding. And who is this elderly couple, you ask? You'll find when you've closely explored it that here is that rare, most conservative pair who waited till they could afford it. And finally, parental pride. My day-old son is plenty scrawny, his mouth is wide with screams or yawny. His ears seem larger than he's needing, his nose is flat, his chin receding. His skin is very, very red, he has no hair upon his head. And yet I'm proud as proud can be to hear you say, "He looks like me." Perhaps less well known is David McCord, a graduate of Harvard, who received a citation from Tufts University in 1987 for his work in children's poetry. "Oh, Halloween, what bothers some about these witches is how come, in sailing through the air like bats, they never seem to lose their hats." And a reflection coming from later in life, an epitaph for a waiter. "By and by, God caught his eye." In 1895, Gelett Burgess wrote a little poem that, by some accounts, became the second most quoted poem of its time, second only to The Night Before Christmas. It was called "The Purple Cow." "I never saw a purple cow. I never hoped to see one. But I can tell you anyhow, I'd rather see than be one." Such a to-do was made of that little poem, both publicly and privately, that Burgess came to hate it. So in 1897, he penned a rebuttal. "Ah, yes, I wrote The Purple Cow. I'm sorry now I wrote it. But I can tell you anyhow, I'll kill you if you quote it." Dorothy Parker was a noted author, poet, and critic in New York at the beginning of the 20th century, and she was one of the founding members of the Algonquin Club. Probably her best-known epigram was, "Men seldom make passes at girls who wear glasses." There was also this short verse titled, "Resume." "Razors pain you, rivers are damp, acid stain you, and drugs cause cramp. Guns aren't lawful, nooses give, gas smells awful, you might as well live." Next, a different take on dating is called "A Taking Girl," author unknown. "She took my hand in sheltered nooks. She took my candy and my books. She took that lustrous wrap of fur. She took those gloves I bought for her. She took my words of love and care. She took my flowers, rich and rare. She took my time for quite a while. She took my kisses, made so shy. She took, I must confess, my eye. She took whatever I would buy. And then she took another guy." The next work was inspired by reports of a ghost of a man roaming the stairs of a haunted house in Antigonish, Nova Scotia, Canada. In 1899, it became the poem "Antigonish," written by American educator and poet Hugh Mearns. It is also known as "The Little Man Who Wasn't There." "Yesterday upon the stair, I met a man who wasn't there. He wasn't there again today. Oh, I wish he'd go away. When I came home last night at 3, the man was waiting there for me. But when I looked around the hall, I couldn't see him there at all. Go away, go away. Don't you come back anymore. Go away, and please don't slam the door. Last night I saw upon the stair a little man who wasn't there. He wasn't there again today. Oh, how I wish he'd go away." And now, from Edwin Markham, "Duty." "When duty comes a-knockin' at your gate, welcome him in, for if you bid him wait, he will depart only to come once more and bring 7 other duties to your door." Now some reflections on life by Chicago-born author Shel Silverstein. "No difference. Small as a peanut, big as a giant, we're all the same size when we turn off the light. Rich as a sultan, poor as a mite, we're all worth the same when we turn off the light. Red, black, or orange, yellow, or white, we all look the same when we turn off the light. So maybe the way to make everything right is for God to just reach out and turn off the light." And the bridge halfway. "This bridge will only take you halfway there to those mysterious lands you long to see, through gypsy camps and swirling Arab fairs and moonlit woods where unicorns run free. So come and walk a while with me and share the twisting trails and wondrous worlds I've known. But this bridge will only take you halfway there. The last few steps you'll have to take alone." One of the most noted forms of humorous verse is the limerick. The name of the poetic form seems to indicate the city or county of Limerick in Ireland, and may refer to a kind of poetic game that used to be played that ended with the refrain, "Won't you or will you come to Limerick?" As, "There was a young rustic named Mallory, who drew but a very small salary. When he went to the show, his purse made him go to a seat in the uppermost gallery." And such verses were sung to the very familiar tune of "Won't You Come to Limerick?" One of the most famous purveyors of Limerick poetry was Englishman Edward Lear, who wrote what he called nonsense poetry. He was born in 1812 and was known to have been one of the illustrators of the poetry of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. He even composed and published musical settings for 12 of Longfellow's works. Maybe the best biography of Lear is one that he wrote of himself. "How pleasant to know Mr. Lear, who has written such volumes of stuff. Some think him ill-tempered and queer, but a few think him pleasant enough. His mind is concrete and fastidious. His nose is remarkably big. His visage is more or less hideous. His beard, it resembles a wig. He has ears and 2 eyes and 10 fingers, leastway if you reckon 2 thumbs. Long ago he was one of the singers, but now he is one of the dumbs. He sits in a beautiful parlor with hundreds of books on the wall. He drinks a great deal of Marsala, but never gets tipsy at all. And so, to one of his limericks. There was an old man in a barge whose nose was exceedingly large, but in fishing at night it supported a light which helped that old man in a barge. Most limericks are from poets unknown, and though some might be slightly indelicate, they are many that are still fun, as a certain young chap named Bill Beebe was in love with a lady named Phoebe, but he said, "I must see what the clerical fee be before Phoebe be Phoebe Beebe." Or what may be the origin of a verse that was well used when I was growing up? "A flea and a fly in the flue were imprisoned, so what could they do? Said the fly, 'Let us flee.' Said the flea, 'Let us fly.' So they flew through a flaw in the flue." And in ending the limericks, one that appeals to a perverse sense of meter. There once was a poet named Stan, whose verses would never quite scan. When the question arose of the state of his prose, he said, "I always try to get as many syllables into the last and final line as I ever possibly can." In closing our venture into humorous and nonsense poetry, we return to Edward Lear. Many will remember The Owl and the Pussycat, but how about The Duck and the Kangaroo? Said the duck to the kangaroo, "Good gracious, how you hop over the fields and the water too, as if you never would stop. My life is a bore in this nasty pond, and I long to go out in the world beyond. I wish I could hop like you," said the duck to the kangaroo. "Please give me a ride on your back," said the duck to the kangaroo. "I would sit quite still and say nothing but quack the whole of the long day through. And we'd go to the Dee and the Jelly Bolee, over the land and over the sea. Please take me a ride, oh do," said the duck to the kangaroo. Said the kangaroo to the duck, "This requires some little reflection. Perhaps on the whole it might bring me luck, and there seems but one objection, which is, if you let me speak so bold, your feet are unpleasantly wet and cold, and would probably give me the rheumatiz," said the kangaroo. Said the duck, "As I sat on the rocks, I have thought over that completely, and I brought 4 pairs of worsted socks, which fit my web feet neatly. And to keep out the cold, I bought a cloak, and every day a cigar I'll smoke, all to follow my own dear true love of a kangaroo." Said the kangaroo, "I'm ready, all in the moonlight pale, but to balance me well, dear duck, sit steady, and quite at the end of my tail." So away they went with a hop and a bound, and they hopped the whole world 3 times round, and who so happy, oh who, as the duck and the kangaroo. This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And thank you for listening in to the Poetry Corner.